all of you for coming. This is an amazing turnout, which is great. My name is Lisa Manning. I'm from the Office of Protected Resources at NOAA Fisheries Headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I'm joined by my colleague tonight, Susie Terling. She's in our Alaska Regional Office in Juneau. And welcome to tonight's public hearing. We're having this public hearing on the proposed rule to designate critical habitat for humpback whales. That proposed rule published in early October. The comment period is open till the end of this month. So tonight's public hearing, the purpose of it is to hear from all of you and get your comments on the record on the proposed rule. There are two ways. Tonight you can submit a comment. Susie probably explained that to you when you came in. You can fill out a speaker card. If you haven't done that yet, you can still do it. This is if you want to give an oral comment tonight. We have a court reporter here. You'll be capturing all your comments for the record so we can fully consider what you have to say before we develop our final rule. If you don't want to speak tonight, but you do want to leave a comment with us tonight, we have a form. You can fill that out and leave a written comment as well. There are other ways to submit comments before that close of that comment period. You can submit comments by mail, and instructions on how to do that are in the proposed rule. But the best way is to go online, www.regulations.gov, and submit your comments electronically. If you search on humpback whales or this docket number that's on this slide right here, that's the best way to access all the information. The proposed rule and copies of all the supporting documents will be there for you, including a copy of tonight's presentation. And for any listeners on the line, same for you, please access that information. So the format for tonight's hearing is I'm going to give a quick presentation that goes over basics of critical habitat and also how we did the proposed rule. And then we will have a brief question and answer period to answer any clarifying questions about the proposed rule itself. And then we got to move into the oral comment period of the hearing. So in terms of what I'm going to present to you tonight, we're going to talk about critical habitat. What is critical habitat? What are the requirements for designating critical habitat? And what is the effect of a critical habitat designation? And then I'm going to get into the specifics of the humpback whale proposed rule itself. So specifically, why are we doing this now? How did we develop the proposed rule? Where are the areas we're actually proposing to designate? And then what kinds of information are going to be helpful to the agency as we move forward with a final rule? And then just really quickly, there is a lot of information that supports this rule, and I'm only able to give you a quick summary of that in the presentation, so I do really encourage you to go read not just the proposed rule itself, but there are multiple supporting documents that are available for you to look at and also comment on. And those are available on regulations.gov, but they're also all posted on our website, and you can find them, hopefully, we have a new website, by searching under Find a Species or under Resources and looking under Rules and Regulations, and all the materials are there. Okay, so starting with the basics of critical habitat. What is critical habitat? Critical habitat is defined in Section 3 of the Endangered Species Act as the specific areas within the geographical area occupied by that listed species that contain physical or biological features that are one, essential to the conservation of the species, and that two, may require special management considerations or protections. There's a second kind of critical habitat defined in Section 3, and that is areas that are outside the geographical area occupied by the species, if those areas are essential to the conservation of the species. So there's these two types of critical habitat, and for short, we usually refer to them as occupied and unoccupied critical habitat. Okay, so there are requirements laid out in the statute that dictate how we actually go about designating critical habitat. We have to designate critical habitat based on the best available scientific information. That's number one. And number two, we have to consider the impacts of that designation. And specifically, we have to consider the economic, the national security, and the other relevant impacts of a critical habitat designation. And then, under Section 42 of the Endangered Species Act, we may exclude areas from a critical habitat designation if we make a determination that that exclusion, the benefits of that exclusion, outweigh the benefits of conservation to the species, and if any such exclusion won't result in the extinction of the species. There are things we cannot do, and that's also dictated by statute. We cannot, and our regulations, we cannot designate the entire range of a species unless there's a really good reason to do that. So, for example, really narrow endemic species, maybe you have to designate the entire range. It's very rare for us. We cannot designate areas covered by what's called an integrated natural resource management plan, or an INRAM for short. Those are plans that the Department of Defense develops for lands that they own or control. Any lands that have a plan, an INRAM that meets certain criteria, those lands are precluded from a critical habitat designation. It's a very specific requirement. And also, lastly, and most importantly, we cannot designate areas outside U.S. jurisdiction. So no critical habitat in the waters of foreign countries. Okay, so the important part. What is the effect of a critical habitat designation? So the regulatory effect of a critical habitat designation is once designated, federal agencies are required under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act to ensure that their actions are not going to destroy or adversely modify that critical habitat. Now, a federal action is anything that a federal agency is doing, authorizing, like through issuance of a permit, or funding, like through issuance of a grant. That's a federal action. So this requirement to ensure they don't destroy or adversely modify critical habitat is in addition to a requirement that federal agencies already have for their actions to avoid jeopardizing the continued existence of a listed species. So under Section 7, federal agencies already have to avoid jeopardy, and when critical habitat is designated, they have that added requirement that they also avoid destroying or adversely modifying the critical habitat.
I didn't understand what you said.
We can go over it again.
Yeah, thanks.
Right, so basically under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, there's already, anytime a species is listed, federal agencies are required to avoid jeopardizing the continued existence of that species during any course of doing anything that a federal agency might do, like Army Corps doing a project, Army Corps issuing a permit, or NOAA Fisheries issuing a grant. Those are federal actions. We have to make sure those federal actions are not worsening the conditions of a listed species. When we designate critical habitat adds a layer of protection under Section 7 over and above what's already required to avoid jeopardizing the species' existence. So it's a tool for federal agencies under Section 7 of the ESA. There are other non-regulatory benefits from critical habitat that sometimes occur. For instance, when we create these maps and we designate critical habitat, those maps can sometimes help other resource managers identify key areas or key habitats to focus their efforts. It sometimes stimulates voluntary conservation and scientific efforts, as well as outreach and education. There are things critical habitat does not do. And this is really important because there's a lot of misperception about what critical habitat is. We put these maps out and it really scares some people because they think this means something for everything that occurs in that area, and that is not the case. There has to be a federal action for critical habitat to have an effect. So critical habitat does not establish any kind of preserve or sanctuary or a closed area. It doesn't shut down fisheries that occur in that area. Critical habitat does not do that as a direct effect of us doing this role. Critical habitat does not affect private activities like recreational boating. It doesn't affect the use of private lands. You have to have a federal action. So something that a federal agency is doing, authorizing, or funding, that is what is affected by a critical habitat designation. Okay, so that's the 101 on critical habitat. So for the humpback whale rule, okay, so why are we proposing critical habitat for humpback whales now? They've been listed under the Endangered Species Act for a long time. So in 2016, there was a global status review for humpback whales, and the listing was revised. So through that global status review process, we identified 14 distinct population segments, or DPSs for short. So the Endangered Species Act defines species as species, subspecies, and distinct population segments of vertebrates. So So there's those three types of species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act. So that global status review identified these 14 DPSs. 9 of them were found to not meet the definition of threatened or endangered, and they are no longer protected under the Endangered Species Act. However, 4 of them were still found to be at risk of extinction. They had low abundance numbers. They're still facing serious threats. They were listed as endangered. 1 additional DPS was found to be facing extinction in the foreseeable future, and that one was listed as threatened. So we had these 5 DPSs that were listed in 2016. That action triggered the legal requirement under the Endangered Species Act to designate critical habitat to the maximum extent prudent and determinable. That's the language of the statute. There is also a statutory timeline for us doing this. We missed that timeline, and a lawsuit was filed, and we have a settlement agreement that dictates deadlines for us for getting the proposed rollout, which we've already met, and for getting the final rollout. The settlement agreement gives us a final rule deadline of September 2020. That's when you can expect us to try to get this done. Okay, so now I'm going to go through the steps of how we develop the proposed rule. This is going to map back to that statutory definition we just looked at already for what the statute says critical habitat is. So the first step is to look at the geographical area occupied by the species. So this map is basically showing you during that global status review that was done, they identified those 14 DPSs. So these blue areas on this map are depicting the breeding areas for all of the 9 non-listed DPSs. So the ones to focus on, that's a laser pointer, are that pink oval with the number 3 on it, if you can see that, off the Philippines and Japan. That is showing you the breeding area for the endangered Western North Pacific DPS. That is one of the 3 DPSs we're concerned with in the proposed rule we're talking about tonight. And pink oval number 6, that's showing you where the breeding area is for the endangered Central America.
Hopefully.
Central America DPS, thank you. I don't know if you guys can see this or not.
Yeah, it's not gonna work, is it?
That's okay. Thank you. So that pink oval number 6 that you see in Central America, that's what that breeding area for the endangered Central America DPS. It breeds off the coast of Panama up into Guatemala and potentially southern Mexico. And then last but not least, that yellowish oval that has the 5 on it, that's the breeding area for the threatened Mexico DPS of humpback whales. So those are the 3 DPSs we're talking about tonight. And all of them, those 3 DPSs all feed in the North Pacific up in waters off the coast of the United States and some into Russia. So those are shown by those green ovals that don't have any kind of label on them. Those feeding areas are not unique to a specific DPS. The listed DPSs overlap on their feeding grounds. They're separate, mainly separate on their breeding grounds, but they mix on the feeding grounds. So specifically, we have mixing of the endangered Western North Pacific DPS whales with Mexico DPS whales in Alaska. And off the coast of Washington, Oregon, California, we have mixing of the Mexico DPS whales and the Central America DPS whales, okay? So that's the occupied range. It includes not just these breeding areas and their feeding areas, but the thousands of miles of ocean that separates them. That's their occupied area or their range. So after we laid that out, we looked at what are those essential physical and biological features in those areas that they're occupying that are in U.S. waters. And an obvious answer is they're coming here to feed. So an essential feature for them while they're here is their prey. And we propose to define that prey feature as it's written out on this slide as prey species, primarily euphausids and small pelagic schooling fishes of sufficient quality, abundance, and accessibility within their feeding areas to support their feeding and population growth. So that's how it's spelled out in the rule. And it meets that, if you remember that statutory definition I showed you, has to meet that second prong of the definition about may require special management considerations or protection. We found that it meets that test as well because mainly far and away because of climate change impacts that we're seeing to the prey feature. In addition, some direct harvest of those prey species in commercial fisheries, things like ocean noise and pollution, including microplastics, are a concern. We did look to see whether there are any other kinds of features to include or other types of habitat, like breeding habitat or migratory habitat, but ultimately none of those are included in the proposed rule. So it's feeding habitat with an essential feature of prey. So the next step in the process was to delineate these specific areas. Critical habitat is defined as these specific areas occupied by the species and that contain this feature. So we used a lot of different kinds of data to do this exercise. We used humpback whale sightings data. We used photo identification data and genetic data, which gives us information at the level of the DPS. Humpback whales that are mixing, we've got non-listed whales in Alaska, and we have two different DPSs of listed whales in Alaska. So we had to use that kind of information to actually pinpoint the distribution of the listed whales. We also looked at satellite tag and telemetry data, which we can look at the tracks of the whales, not just where they're going to and from, but also we can pull out data that talks about when the whales are undergoing this, what's called area-restricted search behavior, so we know they're actively feeding in those areas. We also used habitat models and ecosystem assessments that are available to us that talk about where that prey feature is going to be found and other environmental factors that help us predict where humpback whales are going to be found. We'd like to add to this body of data we used during the public comment period. We're looking for any additional available data that we did not have at the time we developed the proposed rule, including things like local and traditional knowledge, if that's available to us for some places in Alaska where, that are data poor. We would really greatly appreciate that kind of information. Oh, and I should say, the map that you're looking at, we subdivided the feeding areas as finely as we could to feed into a later analysis I'll get into. But the map is showing you, so the dark green line shows the extent of the area we had to consider. That's the US EEZ that you see. And then the colored areas that have numbers on them, those are areas for each DPS that we determined met the definition of critical habitat. So areas in that sort of bright green, 1 through 9, were areas under consideration as critical habitat for the Western North Pacific DPS. Areas 1 through 19, that's all of them, those were under consideration for the Mexico DPS. It's a very broadly distributed DPS. It occurs on all of the major U.S., all of the U.S. feeding grounds. And then lastly, the Central America DPS only occurs off the coast of Washington, Oregon, and California. So those areas labeled 11 through 19 were under consideration for designation for that DPS.
You got a percentage breakdown on that?
And you'll see that these maps again. So the next step in the process was to look at these integrated natural resource management plans. Anything that fit under a plan that was met certain criteria, we are not allowed to designate those areas, so we did have to go through this step, talking to Department of Defense, and ultimately, and I'll just kind of gloss over this, but U.S. Navy did have a couple areas that met the criteria here. Those are all off of the coast of Southern California, so we had to adjust, we made really slight adjustments to those boundaries of the specific areas we had originally drawn to avoid those U.S. Navy areas. They're all pretty small. And then the next step, we are required to look to see if there were unoccupied areas that met the definition of critical habitat for all of these DPSs, and I'll just also do this really quickly. Ultimately, we decided no, there are no unoccupied areas that are essential to the conservation. Humpback whales are pretty much distributed throughout their historical range right now, so there are no unoccupied areas that we were going to propose to say were essential to conservation at this time. So the proposed rule is exclusively about occupied critical habitat. Okay, so now it's getting into the 4B2 analysis, what we call the 4B2 analysis. If you remember, I said we had to look at, when we designate critical habitat, we have to look at the impacts of that designation, and specifically economic, national security, and other relevant impacts. So in terms of the economic impacts, what we have to do is we have to look at the incremental effects of a critical habitat rule. That means What we're doing is we're comparing the world without this critical habitat to a world with this critical habitat and looking at that incremental cost that would happen as a result of this rule, not as a result of anything else that's already in place. So not costs that are as a result of the listing, but just costs that are exclusive to this particular rulemaking. And we break those costs into two different types. There's what we call administrative costs and project modification costs. The administrative costs are basically that added cost that federal agencies and others incur, like a project applicant potentially, for doing that added analysis that they have to go through to complete an analysis of the critical habitat. Then there could also be these project modification costs, and those are the costs that would occur if you have to change your project in some way, or you change your federal action in some way to avoid destroying or adversely modifying the critical habitat. So there's those two types of costs we try to tease out in the analysis. And to do the economic analysis, what we do is we go back 10 years in our consultation records, and we look at what are the federal activities that are occurring in these areas that we're looking at, and what are the nature of these consultations. And then we also do outreach to federal agencies like BOEM and Army Corps and access information that they have about planned future federal activities in these areas. So we feed all of that into this analysis. The draft economic analysis, which is available for review, basically broke up the federal activities into 12 major categories, and those things range from federal fisheries. So those are consultations with ourselves, NOAA Fisheries, on changes to federal fisheries management, consultations with BOEM on oil and gas activities, like seismic surveys, and far and away, the largest category of consultations across the board, and specifically for Alaska, were in-water construction activities. And those are usually consultations with the Army Corps, but sometimes it's with another federal agency as well, like the Department of Transportation. That was our largest category. And ultimately, the findings of the analysis talk about how we are not predicting any project modifications as a result of this critical habitat designation. So the costs exclusively that we were able to monetize fall exclusively in that administrative cost category that I mentioned. There were no project modifications predicted for the vast majority of projects. The economic analysis does talk about how in a couple cases, we just couldn't come up with any project modifications or costs associated with them because the projects were, the future activities in some categories were just far too speculative. And you can, that is discussed in the analysis. And then shown on this slide, by DPS, Western North Pacific, Central America, and Mexico DPS, those are the estimated annualized costs per DPS over the next 10 years. So our economic analysis is forecasting costs over the future of a 10-year time horizon. So those costs, far and away, are very low, especially relative to the level of economic activity in the areas we're looking at, and also relative to a lot of other critical habitat designations. And then just drilling down a little bit further for because of where we are, this map, if you can see the yellow hashed area with a little 10, that is what we were calling for our analysis unit 10, but that's Southeast Alaska. And you can see the next area over, there's a faint line, and unit 9 is right there too. But the dots on this map are showing you, in that analysis we did where we looked back over the past 10 years about the consultations and the kind of consultations and where they occurred, this map is plotting those out for you. So most of those dots, and you probably can't see the colors, but most of those dots, like I said, those are in-water construction project activities that are occurring in Southeast Alaska. And most of those are what we call, most of what we had done for those projects were what's called informal consultations. Those are shorter consultations that take about 30 days to complete. And those are for activities that are things that we've determined may affect the listed species there or the critical habitat. This is prior to critical habitat for humpback whale. So, but that the agency have decided they're not likely to adversely affect the listed species. So those can fall into that category of informal consultations. What's not shown on this map, so this actually, the dots on this map represent about 71% of the consultations that occurred over the past 10 years. The remainder, either there were no geographic reference points for us to use to plot them, or for the other consultations that you're not seeing on this map, there are things like consultations on federal fisheries, which are not specific to a particular area. Those apply, the costs and our analysis are applied statewide. Those fisheries are happening over a broad area. They're not happening in Southeast Alaska exclusively. So they're not a dot on this map. That makes sense.
Can you elaborate on the vessel traffic dot?
Let's do that after I'm done. But the other thing, speaking of federal fisheries, before I get off this slide, I did want to not forget to mention that in terms of the federal fisheries in Alaska, based on our consultation history and how through those consultations we consider the effect of those fisheries on that prey feature for humpback whales, we're not forecasting any modifications to the federal fisheries. Because there's no basis to do that based on our consultation history and what we understand in terms of the impact of those federal fisheries on the prey species for humpback whales. In addition to that, there's already what we call high baseline protections in place for those prey species. So the species that humpback whales are targeting that are part of that essential feature of the critical habitat are species like euphausids or krill and those small pelagic schooling fish that they're targeting in Alaska, which includes Pacific herring, capelin, sandlands. Those species, those are prohibited species in the federal fisheries. There's no federal directed fisheries for those. So we're not forecasting, because of that high baseline protection that's already there for those prey species, we're not forecasting a change to the federal fisheries as a result of this critical habitat designation. If you have questions on that, we'll get to that again. Okay, so moving on to 4B2 analysis, we have a look at national security impacts. That involves reaching out to Department of Defense and also the Department of Homeland Security, specifically the Coast Guard, to ask whether or not this critical habitat designation would impact national security or military readiness in any way. Through that process, the U.S. Navy identified two areas that they wanted us to exclude because of impacts on their activities. And cut to the chase on that, we did agree with them that these two particular areas could result in impacts on their training and testing activities that take place in these areas. One of them is a very small area, about 48 square nautical miles near Ketchikan. It's the Southeast Alaska Acoustic Measurement Facility. We're proposing to exclude from all the critical habitat designations, and then this Knalt Range site, which is off the coast of Washington. We're also proposing to exclude that. And they asked for a buffer around it for various reasons. But we're proposing to exclude that area too. And that's discussed in detail in our proposed rule and this 4B2 report, which is available. Okay, and then last but not least, under 4B2, we have to look at other relevant impacts. And a big one for us is always to look at potential impacts on federally recognized tribes and Native Alaska corporations, and that's our policy. And under secretarial and administrative orders, we always consult with and coordinate with tribes when designating critical habitat. So we did a lot of outreach very early on in the process to tribes, and we're trying to continue that through the public comment period to make sure their voices are adequately heard and fed into this process. We did have a couple tribes in Washington that participate in our coastal pelagic species fishery, and that's the main fishery we're concerned about here with this rule. Those two tribes do participate in that fishery, and they did have some concerns. We did have a technical meeting with that tribe to exchange information, but ultimately they didn't request any exclusions or ask for any actual formal consultation with us. So we are, like I said, continuing to try to do outreach to all the tribes to make sure we get their input. Okay, so now getting to the final part. If you remember that original map, those areas 1 through 9 that you're seeing off the coast of Alaska, those were the areas that we found met the definition under the ESA for critical habitat for that Western North Pacific DPS. We did decide to enter into this 4B2 balancing process to look to see whether the benefits of designating some of these areas were outweighed by the impacts of designating them. So to in order to do this, we did a qualitative assessment of the conservation value of all of these areas, rating them very high to low, and we did that by looking at the distribution of humpback whales, as well as what kinds of information do we have about the particular distribution and use of these areas by that whales of that DPS. And then we fed that into our, we compared that to the economic costs, and even though, like I said, a lot of the economic costs, they're all very low for these areas, we did conclude that for some of these areas, the humpback whales of this DPS are not really relying heavily on some of these areas as feeding habitat. So we are proposing to exclude 5 of these 9 areas from the critical habitat designation for this DPS. So out of this original map of areas under consideration after the 4B2 process was over, this is what the proposed designation looks like. So the green areas are the proposed critical habitat. So you've got this Bristol Bay area, this Eastern Aleutian area, and an area around Kodiak that are included in the proposed rule. That's about 79,000 square nautical miles of marine habitat, and we're proposing to exclude about 44,000. So we're currently taking comment on that. So for the Mexico DPS, this is our threatened DPS. It is the most broadly distributed, as I mentioned, so it occurs in all of these areas. So on the table, these areas 1 through 19, we did that same exact process that I just mentioned for the Western North Pacific. We compared the conservation benefits of designating each of these specific areas versus those different impacts we had identified, and we are proposing to exclude, on the basis of economic considerations, we're proposing to exclude 2 areas in the Gulf of Alaska and 1 off of Southern California, and then we're proposing to exclude those 2 Navy areas that I already mentioned. One in Southeast Alaska and one off the coast of Washington. So the map is gonna look like this. It looks like this in the proposed rule. So these green areas with a few gaps for the excluded areas shown here, that upper inset box is just showing you where that Southeast Acoustic Measurement Facility is located. And then that middle inset box is that Kanawha Range site off the coast of Washington. So in total, this is about 176,000 square nautical miles that we're proposing to designate for this DPS, and we're proposing to exclude about 32,000 square nautical miles. And then last but not least, Central America DPS, same exact process, and I'll just cut to the chase on this one. We're proposing to exclude that same area off Southern California and that same Kanawha Range site off the coast of Washington for this DPS. So that this proposed designation includes about 48,000 square nautical miles, and we're proposing to exclude about 15,000. So maps for this area, a lot of detail about the boundaries and how that was all determined is all in the biological report and the proposed rule, if you want to look really closely at any of these specific areas. Okay, so during the public comment period, we're really looking for data that tell us more about the distribution of whales from each of the DPSs, if anything new is available that we weren't able to look at when we developed the rule. We would love to have that information. Any more detail about the boundaries and how they should be drawn for the proposed areas. Any types of federal activities we didn't fully capture, any project modifications that we should have monetized in our economic analysis, or any current or planned activities we didn't capture, and any other impacts basically that we didn't consider yet. And we want all that, and we'll feed that into our development of the final rule before the agency makes the final decision. And that's that for the presentation. So, where did Susie go? So we're going to do a quick check
right now. And if anyone has speaker cards and are interested in providing testimony tonight, you can give that to me.
And then, so we'll, I don't, there could be people on the phone, but we'll start with in the room. With any clarifying questions on what I talked about or questions you have, we'll do those, and then we'll get into the public comment portion of tonight's hearing. Yes, in the hallway.
Just to clarify, so you're only, the only impacts in the future, do you foresee any impacts where the feds would come in at some point and take some oversight over state managed fisheries in regards to the critical habitat areas?
We don't have the authority to take over management of state fisheries.
Or have any impacts of closed waters that would have any impacts on the fisheries?
If there was ever a change to state managed fisheries, it wouldn't be as a direct result of this rule.
But doesn't that section 7 put us in that position where they can actually, you guys can come out after us? I mean, right now the trawlers are under that Section 7. And you're saying that we're going to all be under that Section 7 now because of the Endangered Species Act, or am I wrong to say that? So you can come after us with that Section 7.
So
exactly.
So
I'm sorry, but that Section 7, when you brought that up, that scared the hell out of me.
Right, so Section 7 does apply, the requirements to comply with Section 7 apply to NOAA Fisheries. NOAA Fisheries manages the federal fisheries in Alaska with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council and the International Pacific Halibut Commission and other bodies, right? So yeah, those are federal decisions. They are required to meet the law of the Endangered Species Act, that how those fisheries decisions are made in management of those fisheries, they're subject to Section 7, so you're right about that. But the come after you part is probably not correct, because what our analysis is telling us and what our historical management of humpback whales, which we have decades of experience doing, those federal fisheries, based on the information we have now, those federal fisheries are not taking humpback whale prey in any large amount. So this critical habitat rule doesn't trigger a change in how those fisheries are going to be managed. So in translation, that's not going to then affect the fishermen operating under those fisheries management plans.
Yeah, it's not directly, you kept saying directly, yeah, but indirectly.
So
you can backdoor right into something, or not you, but somebody could.
So for this critical habitat rule to affect federal fisheries, you would have to get to an adverse modification or destruction outcome in a Section 7 consultation. And the likelihood of that occurring is pretty much non-existent right now. So when you say in the future, am I going to predict out 25 years from now with climate change impacts and things that are going on? No, I'm not going to do that right now. We have to do the work, we have to do the analysis. We're required to do that under Section 7. So I can't predict out beyond what we're currently projecting. I can't guarantee anything, is what I'm trying to tell you. Yes.
But on that same thread, wasn't that in the same position when critical habitat for the Stellar Sea Lion was developed and we had cod fisheries shut down?
So, Stellar Sea Lions is people like to bring this up. Stellar Sea Lions is a very different situation. Stellar Sea Lions were in dire situation. They were very endangered. And there were other restrictions that were put in place above and beyond critical habitat that dictated that outcome. So there were regulations put in place about approaching rookeries and things like that, and there were regulations put in place about fishing within certain areas. Those are separate regulations, separate and apart from critical habitat designation. And that the situation that was facing Stellar Sea Lions then is not the situation humpback whales are facing right now. We don't have population trends for each of the individual DPSs yet. We're working towards that, but the general trend for the North Pacific is an increasing trend in population abundance for humpback whales. So we just really don't have the same situation that was happening with Stellar Sea Lions back in 2010.
But your position to calm people was that you didn't, Noah didn't anticipate it. Was the talking point from Noah at that time? And
decisions that were made, not relevant to this hearing. I mean,
the answer is yes. This is a completely analogous situation. And once we get somebody, you can already tell that they're of religious belief of global warming and ocean acidification. When we get an administration in there that is of the same denomination, this is going to be used against us. Now, I don't want to cast dispersions. I believe that you could possibly be pure of heart. But the people that come behind you, I don't know what the competition is with bureaucrats to gain points, but it seems to be escalation. It's progressive. We started out with a cost recovery system of 0.8%. All of a sudden, we get the right bureaucrat in there, and it's 3% every year.
So we're going to, if there are any more questions, let's do those. And then it sounds like you will probably want to make a comment on the record. Get that in as your comment.
We need something to voice our comments too. Okay. Just getting up and making comments has no purpose whatsoever.
Well, okay, how about we do it and then we'll go back to you?
Okay. I don't want to steer the conversation.
Well, I just had a question. I was trying to find the data on the Mexican
DPS.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was just making sure I was the right person. My understanding is that there's the mainland population and then there's the rural population that
correct.
Comes to Southeast Alaska, and you look at them as a whole. Can you give us data on the difference populations between the two? Because the mainland population doesn't come to Southeast.
So, and then when you mean data on the difference.
The numbers of individuals occupying those territories for breeding grounds.
That'd be the percentage.
So yeah, there is an analysis done that is cited throughout the biological report and the proposed rule that does try to tease that out. So that analysis looks at predicted movements of whales that breed off the Revillagigedos Islands versus the mainland portion of Mexico. So there are. You're absolutely right. So that DPS is weird. So some of the whales are moving to Washington, Oregon, California, and some of them are headed to Alaska. There's a little bit of, it's not a perfect one-to-one on that, but there are predicted movement probabilities that are out there. Those are going to be revised. So unfortunately, the statute and the way this all works is we have this timeline and we have to have this completed. But right now, what's going on in the background is there's a massive effort going on. So those predicted probabilities, I should back up and point out, they're all based off this massive basin-wide study that was done in the early 2000s, over three breeding seasons and two feeding seasons. And that study is called the SPLASH study, and you'll probably hear a lot about it or see a lot about it in the documents. That study involved 400 researchers, 10 countries. It was a massive undertaking to try and understand where whales were moving, what the structure of populations was, and what the abundances were, and the status of humpback whales in the entire North Pacific. That data are now, those are getting stale, right? That was done a long time ago now, but it is still the best available we have for predicting where the whales are going and matching a whale from point A and point B. It's very challenging to do this because it's a massive area. But there's a big effort going on that the International Whaling Commission is involved with, that they're going to be updating the status of humpback whales in the entire North Pacific. We're a couple years away from having all of those data available. People are working on that as we speak. They're finding matches, not just map photo ID matches of whales, not just in new data that are being acquired as we speak, but also in old data sets, because there's an effort to pull in all these photo ID catalogs into this one massive effort. So hopefully through that process, we'll know a lot more about, you know, where the whales are moving to and from, and there is a way to revise critical habitat. So, you know, if we ever get to that point, I think we would be happy to.
That doesn't answer my question. So I understand there's some new data by way about probability.
It's available.
Where they go. I've seen, I've read it. But my question is, of the estimated population of the Mexican whales, how many are of the Revillagigedo? Because those are the ones that come here.
Right, so you would just take
his... I want to know
his
numbers.
Yeah, you would just take
no,
his...
2% moved to Alaska. That doesn't tell me what their population is.
It is in Appendix C of our biological report. You can take those probabilities from Wade 2017
yeah.
and multiply by whatever abundance estimate you want to use. There's several out there.
Yeah.
So multiply by 2,800, that's mm-hmm. one of the most current abundance estimates, and then you get your number. He has one table that splits out movement of those whales, mainland Mexico whales from the island Mexico whales. So that's one analysis. You can do that. Manage the DPS as a DPS, not by parts of DPSs. So we didn't look at that specifically. I don't have that to you specifically. Okay, next question.
Yes. You're talking in your documents about the competition for prey, of the prey for your for the food stores. In there. But you don't, it's kind of vague. It doesn't say really what does. You think there's increased competition, but you don't really say what it is. One, and two, in the documents that I read, you don't really talk about your prey species food sources out there. Are the food sources changing? Are the food sources increasing? Which would change where the whale ranges? What is the thought process and what are you looking at?
I don't know that I fully understand what you're asking. We did look at both historical and contemporary data in terms of what the whales are eating, and that's presented in the biological report. I'm not sure what else to tell you.
You say in there there's competition now.
Competition? I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about. Competition.
And other species other than the whale competing for that same food source. Read in there in a couple places where thought there not a lot of information, one. And two, that there wasn't, that there was nothing in there that suggests a movement of that food source or the size and extent of that food source. That I read, is it in there?
So competition for prey, humpback whales and between humpback whales and other predators in the system, no, we don't get at that. So we didn't look at that when determining what areas meet the definition of critical habitat. What we look at is what habitats are the whales using and what is the essential feature in that habitat. And that dictates how we define critical habitat. Whether they're competing with other species for prey, we may mention briefly that, you know, fin whales, their diet overlaps with humpbacks, and there's some hypotheses and some evidence in some areas that they kind of segregate themselves, but we don't, it's not really entirely germane to how we go about determining critical habitat for humpback whales. So no, we don't get into that, and you're probably correct that it's not something we talk about. In terms of movement of prey, if you're referring to climate change and the expectation that prey distributions are going to shift, we don't have tremendously great information on that for the areas we're talking about. There's nothing we can look at in the literature that says the central distribution of krill in this area is shifting this far over time. There's a recent paper out that talks about that for Antarctica, but not for our areas. What I can tell you is we did try to, you know, the data that are available to us straddle time periods before and after the warm blob event of, you know, 2013 to 2016, where we had anomalously warm ocean conditions. So there's some modeling data out there that has both cold water years and warm water years, and so all of that was looked at. So we are considering, you know, where are the prey, where are the whales, in all of these different ocean conditions. What's gonna happen in the future, we don't have a crystal ball to really tell us yet, so.
We can look precedent and figure out that's what.
So let's take a few more questions and then we'll get into, you've been waiting patiently in the blue orchard.
I think it's a good time. I was curious on if you could elaborate a little more on Section 6.
Section 6?
Section 6, if you're familiar with that, and
very.
I'm sure you are, but it seems like it's been used before with some other species in the state of Alaska, and why it hasn't...
So, are you talking about cooperation
consultation with the states? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so please. Our Section 6 program for NOAA fisheries is primarily a grant program where we fund state conservation programs. That's primarily what our program is.
Yeah.
Through Section 6 and through Section 6 agreements we develop with state natural resource agencies, we talk about what the priorities are for species that are in greatest need in that state, and then we work together to identify important projects that should take place, and then we try to fund those projects through what's called the Species Recovery Grants Program. And that's been working really well for us. I don't know that you had something else. Probably
had
something else in mind.
I did, but that's okay.
I'll let you know. Okay. We can talk. I'll be available after too if you want to talk more about that. Any other questions? Let's take one or two more. Okay, two hands. So we'll you in the hat and then we'll
Lonnie's got a question that the decision to close down, or not close down, but move the California Dungeness season to move that forward 4 months instead of fishing it when they traditionally fish it. Was that something to do with critical habitat, or was that decided by the state of California?
No, that wasn't determined by critical habitat. So this critical habitat is a proposed rule, has no effect yet. It will only come into effect when it's finalized. But a lot of the Dungeness crab fishermen are very interested in this rule because they want to know if it's somehow going to affect what's going on in California. So the state of California was sued for all the entanglements of humpback whales that resulted because of that. Their fairly catastrophic season. The reason the season was shifted had to do with, and why there were so many entanglements, and why we're in this problem.
The Des Moines acid.
Yes, so there was warm water conditions, shift in distribution of humpback prey closer to shore. There was a Des Moines acid outbreak, so they had delay opening of the Dungeness crab fishery. So what happened was, you had a much greater spatial and temporal overlap between when the fishery was operating and when and where the humpback whales were there to feed.
Yeah.
That is a very dense, very important feeding area for Central America and Mexico DPS humpbacks. So there were a very high spike in the number of entangled whales that occurred. The Center for Biological Diversity has sued the state of California for not having a permit in place for the incidental take of humpback whales. The states of Washington and Oregon have, you know, moved ahead with trying to work on the same, dealing with the same kind of issue to sort of proactively deal with it so they don't get in the same situation. There's a settlement and a lot of stuff going on, and everyone's sort of trying to work through that problem, and are with a lot of support from our science center, they've been able to kind of work things out for now. So,
well, I guess that's kind of what I was getting at, because the state of Alaska would be put into the same situation because of this critical habitat designation.
Well, so again, the Dungeness crab issue was not driven by critical habitat
in
any way.
I understand that, but now that these parts of Alaska will be designated as critical habitat, will the state of Alaska be put into the same situation? I know that this didn't have anything to do with it in California, but
so
now that this is will be designated critical habitat, will Alaska state water fisheries be?
So the situation that happened in California has nothing to do with this rule, and no, this would not happen in Alaska. Entanglement of humpback whales is a take issue. That issue exists with or without critical habitat, because if these whales are listed under the Endangered Species Act, you're not allowed to kill them. One more question, then we'll do it all. Yes.
You talked about federal fisheries. What about state fisheries?
So critical habitat, and this gets at what we were talking about earlier that was, I think, confusing, that critical habitat only affects federal actions. So Pacific herring is a state-managed fishery, right? That's not a federal action, management of that fishery. so that fishery is not affected by this critical habitat designation, the fishery that this ADFNG is managing. And I don't know, I mean, any future change to how the state is managing that fishery is subject to their management authority. So, dispel any rumors that this has anything to do with this role, or that changes to that fishery would have anything to do with this
role. But you talk about forage fish the whole time, and the feds don't manage any forage fisheries in Southeast.
So, yeah, you're right. So the fact that most of the concern is coming from Alaska over how this critical habitat designation would affect federal fisheries is a little bit surprising, because we do have a federal fishery that operates off the coast of Washington, Oregon, California, that does directly target and harvest humpback whale prey species, specific sardine and anchovy. So that is where the action is at in terms of removal at a commercially directed fisheries for humpback whale prey. Other than that, we're not seeing a whole lot of overlap. You know, the fisheries that are operating in Alaska right now, what's going on with them, they're not removing substantial amounts of humpback whale prey.
So, if you don't have a problem with the halibut and the blackcod fisheries, then why make it critical habitat?
So critical habitat is determined again by that statutory definition in the ESA. We are required by law to designate critical habitat to the maximum extent prudent and determinable. If an area meets the definition of critical habitat, it's critical habitat. Fisheries are not the only federal action that occurs. When you have activities like registration of pesticides and herbicides, we consult with EPA on that. We consult with EPA and disposal of materials. We consult with BOEM on the use of massive seismic sonar surveys, which we don't actually have a fantastic scientific understanding yet of how those surveys are affecting krill biomass. So those are things that are happening on a vast scale that we consult on those activities. Same with the military operations. The Navy operates on massive scales with their training and testing ranges, and we consult with them on a whole series of activities that they do. That is why critical habitat, that's how critical habitat has an effect. If you don't designate critical habitat, you remove our ability to consult on those activities and their effect on the critical habitat. But we still would be consulting on them for their effects on the listed whales. So we don't lose all of our ability to manage those activities, but you take away an important aspect of what the Endangered Species Act was intended to do. So, you know, because the species that are in that essential feature of this proposed rule are the forage fish species, not just for listed whales and seabirds and other predators in the system that may not be listed under something, they're the prey species for commercially valuable fish as well. So anything we do to better manage them is beneficial across the board. So it's not just a federal fisheries issue. It's an across-the-board issue for any federal activities that we're authorizing or doing in these areas. The benefits extend well beyond just humpback whales. So I'll just leave it at that. Great. Oh, okay, last one.
In terms of operations, so there's the prey species that we understand is the federal, is a federal issue over the federal fisheries, and there isn't for herring, for instance. But there was all reading some of the document. Also, I understand there's concerns. Are there concerns about like operations of boats and noise and things like that that would be changed the way the feds would take actions or make restrictions based on the new critical habitat designation in terms of how fishing boats can operate within state waters, for instance? Because of noise or
okay, other so noise, so yeah,
interactions.
So I will say, so vessel traffic is discussed in our economic analysis, and I think, so what we try to do, and just I'll answer your question, but I'm going to just put it in context for you. Our economic analysis, what we try to do is we bend over backwards to make sure we're not undercounting. So a lot of the activities that you see in there, we even have like space launch activities because we consult on those in these areas. So they're included. But do we think those activities are going to negatively affect the proposed critical habitat for humpbacks? No, we don't. But we didn't want to undercount them because we have to consult on them. So there's a lot of things that are mentioned in there that we don't foresee having project modifications as a result of this rule. A lot of those activities we consult on for humpback whales because of other factors like entanglement or ship strike. The issue with noise, we already addressed too on effects of noise as harassment and disturbance of humpback whales. So what we do to manage for those activities through a consultation process, for example, we're already managing those activities to minimize that disturbance and those effects on the listed whales. And so because of that, we're not foreseeing that there's going to be anything over and above that because of the critical habitat. Okay, so this is definitely the last question that we've got to take our time.
I can just swing you out of the fisheries for a moment. The islands all receive power by underwater cables. We recently had a cable go out. What are the implications to SEPA and its ability to provide power to the villages?
So that is something that we would probably be consulting on. I think there was one that we consulted on a while back, not in Southeast Alaska, but somewhere in the Eastern Aleutians. And that the outcome of that analysis was a may affect humpbacks, but not likely to adversely affect, which means there was no, with whatever mitigation measures that were already incorporated into how that the activity was being planned, they avoided any issues for the whales. So I would imagine the same would be done here. And what we would do is we would try to make sure we were minimizing any negative effects on the whales and their critical habitat if this critical habitat is finalized. And I don't know where that project is in terms of where it is in progress. Like, have they got all their permits in place and everything already relative to when this rule is going to come out even? So it's hard for me to say specific to your project.
Shutting down the project or complicating the project, but also increased costs to the organization, which means ratepayers have increased costs coming their way. And it's an unintended consequence that people don't think about it. Develop the industrial footprint.
Yeah, and I would say that the answer is probably no in terms of an added cost. So there would probably be, so just hypothetically, let's say it's very early on. This critical habitat gets finalized before your project is permitted or something, and we consult on not just the effects of the project on the whales, but the critical habitat. So say we're in that situation, would there be added costs because of that? There would be added costs, if it's Army Corps that's permitting it, they would have to do that added analysis. It doesn't cost them that much more to do that, and it's gonna depend, the cost depends on what kind of a consultation it is, informal or formal. Probably if it's a formal, it does take longer to do those, so it would take them more effort to put into that analysis. But would they be modifying the project, and would that incur costs? Like, do they have to move the cable? Do they have to put the cable somewhere else, and that adds costs? Does it have to be longer, and that adds costs? Does it have to be deeper, and that adds costs? Things like that. I would say no, it's going to be extremely unlikely for that to happen because of the critical habitat, because a lot of those effects of those kinds of activities are already affecting the whales, and they're already going to have to do whatever mitigation, like observers to minimize hitting the whales, turbidity assessments or something to avoid, I don't know, ruining the habitat. So they're already doing those things. So are they going to do something over and above those? I don't think so. But again, you have to do the analysis